serve you. I'll give you everything.
I'll give you everything.
I will lift up my eyes to your throne.
My eyes to your throne.
I will trust you.
Jesus, He's all we need. Live.
to the King. For His returning we watch and we pray. We will be ready the dawn of that day. We'll join in singing with all the redeemed. Cause Satan is vanquished and Jesus is King.
Ceaseless praise, let them flow in ceaseless. be with us this morning. Do I get to introduce you?
Yes. Love that.
Amy Chesney, let me just tell you guys. You know Amy probably from hearing her speak at Pepperdine. Amy and her husband Nate are at Highland with Cheryl and me, and I'm even getting chills as I'm saying this because I feel so blessed that we have them. Amy teaches Bible at ACU. Amy is not only an amazing singer and an amazing worship leader, but she's also an amazing preacher and theologian. So having that on our team, she is like an amazing gift to us. Her husband Nate is an incredible chef and drummer, and so we're thankful for him too. But this morning, just get ready. You know, your socks are about to be knocked off, so hold on to those. And can we just give Amy a warm welcome here this morning?
Can you hear me? Yes. All right. It is so good to be with you this morning. I know it's early, but you sound lively. I'm used to teaching college students at 8 a.m. And it's not quite as lively as this, I can say that. You know, I'm used to having to do some stunts, like some backflips and really good jokes. So I'm not going to have to pull all the stops with you this morning, but I am really, really excited to be here with you. As Brandon said, my husband and I live in Abilene, Texas, but I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, in the home of a preacher, and I have four older brothers. Let that sink in for a minute. Four older brothers. We're within 6 years of each other, so we all like went through adolescence together. We're all very close in age. And what that meant for me, and I'm sure none of you can relate to this at all, but I felt a little insecure as the runt of the litter. You know, I felt like I had to run 10 times faster and, you know, ride my bike harder. You know, I had to get really good at video games. I joined a baseball team. I did everything I could to try to keep up with the guys. You know, and that boiled down to even one time I think I found a snake and draped it over my neck and brought it into the house. I thought I was tough. My mom, she's still with us after that. But I really struggled with this feeling like I was going to have to be better than I actually am. You know, I was going to have to be tougher. I was going to have to put up this front so that I could compete, so that I could be deemed worthy by my brothers. Well, it all kind of boiled down to video games. It turns out I'm not very good at video games. And there was this Christmas where we got a Nintendo 64. And it was just the best Christmas of our lives to this day. And so we had that Nintendo 64, and we would play it every day. My mom had to start limiting our time on the Nintendo 64. Well, we had this game called 007 GoldenEye. And it's, you know, you kind of, it's a pretty violent game for kids, but we played it, we loved it. I think my mom just appreciated having, like, the solace of us, like, on the video game for an hour every day. But I was terrible at it, absolutely terrible. And I couldn't cope with losing all the time. I didn't want to be a loser. And so what I did is I recreated the game in my head. Maybe the objective for my brothers was to see like how many people they can shoot, which is just awful. I want to reiterate that. Don't go playing these games. But my new task in my head to cope with my loser status was finding the best hiding place. I'm not kidding you. And I would give myself bonus points in the game for how long I could go without being killed. And this is how I coped with being a loser in my family. And I just was reflecting on that recently and thought, like, how sad that that's how terrified I was to be a loser. That's how terrified I was of not being worthy of hanging out with my brothers. And I think about how much that behavior tends to follow me in other places of my life, even into my adult years. And it feels so ridiculous to say that, but you probably know what I'm talking about. Like, if you're being really honest, how many times do you kind of act out of that feeling at work? Or at church, or even maybe still with your family. I think that we kind of lead from this place of insecurity more often than we realize. Because the fact is, we are painfully aware that we live in a world where we're just not enough. We're just not enough. And, you know, somebody's going to let you know that about 10 times a day. That you're not pretty enough. You didn't work hard enough. You don't get to have that promotion. actually, we're going to go ahead and terminate your time here because you're just not enough. We're not going to give you that degree. You're not going to hang out with us because you're not enough. We're caught up in this rat race of appearances. And I don't mean skin surface level appearances. I mean the show that you put on. You know, you get ready in the morning and then you prepare for how you're going to present yourself to the world. And maybe on our best days, we really try to bring an authentic portrayal of who we are. But other days, that is being more manipulated by our fears and our insecurities than we really want to admit. So we're kind of caught up in this rat race of appearances, and it was rigged from the start. This game that we partake in, it was rigged from the start. We're never going to win. I don't know why we think every morning we're going to wake up and today's going to be different. Nobody's going to walk up to you. There's not going to be a billboard that's like, don't buy our product because you're perfect as you are. You know, it doesn't work that way. We're never going to wake up and have that experience. It was rigged from the start. So here's what we tend to think. If I can control my life and my immediate surroundings, or if I can wield whatever power I have really well, then my value will be secure with no margin for error. If I can just secure my little place of power, wherever that might be, whether it's in your house or in particular relationships, or maybe it's only in the way that you look, I don't know what it is for you, but I promise you, each of you have your little spheres of power. We all do. And we will fight anybody off to keep it. Why? Because we think our value is found in this place of security. You know, we really become obsessed with, like, pulling these strings of power, but we're missing out. I think we are missing out on where God is leading us. It's like we're so preoccupied. We have such tunnel vision, but trying to maintain control of how we function in the world, our value in the world, that we really miss out on where God is trying to lead us. And as we do this, we buy into this illusion of false value. It's not even remotely sustainable. Like, not remotely. I think the most obvious would be people who get caught up in controlling their appearances. It's not sustainable. You can only stave off aging for so long. Eventually it catches up. Or maybe it's with your job. Well, eventually you're gonna have to not work anymore. Either you'll retire or death will arrive, but you're not gonna work forever. And so these little places of control, like, we think our value is pent up in them, but it's an illusion. It doesn't actually work. This morning, I want us to take some time to kind of center ourselves on the way of Christ. As Brandon mentioned, I teach at Abilene Christian University, and I've got lots and lots of freshmen. I teach a lot of freshman Bible, in addition to a junior and senior class. But with my freshmen, we've recently been kind of diving into Christology, the study of Christ, developing a rich theology of who Christ is, how Christ's ministry functioned in our world, and what was actually accomplished in the death, burial, and resurrection. So we've been going through the New Testament this semester, working through some different letters, like in Hebrews, and Philippians, and really trying to develop this Christology. And one thing that we have discovered together is that the more we start to work on our Christology, the more we understand about ourselves. It's kind of a funny incident. Like, the more I learn about who Christ was, the more I actually make sense of my existence. The more I make sense of your existence. And so, I want us to look at this this moment in the ministry of Jesus this morning together, because I think it will help us make sense of this tendency that we have that we're exploring this morning. So if you have your Bibles, open up to Luke chapter 4. Luke chapter 4. And we're going to read Luke's account of the wilderness temptations. Starting in verse 1, it says, "Now Jesus, full of the Holy Spirit, returned from Jordan and was led by the Spirit into the wilderness, where for 40 days he was tempted by the devil. He ate nothing at all during those days, and when they were over, he was famished. The devil said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, command this stone to become a loaf of bread.' Jesus answered him, 'It is written, one does not live by bread alone, Then the devil led him up and showed him in an instant all the kingdoms of the world. And the devil said to him, to you I will give their glory and all this authority, for it has been given over to me, and I'll give it to anyone I please. If you then will worship me, it will all be yours. And Jesus answered him, it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him. Then the devil took him to Jerusalem and placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, saying to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you to protect you. And on their hands they will bear you up, so you will not dash your foot against a stone. Jesus answered him, it is said, do not put the Lord your God to the test. So when the devil had finished every test, he departed from him until an opportune time. It took me reading this passage a few times before I really stopped being distracted by the little details. You know, I kind of always thought that maybe the central temptation here is like, and Jesus is hunger. Like, he really wants to eat. I get that. Like, I want to eat all the time. Like, I'm just imagining if I went for 40 days, I would love to turn a stone into like pizza or something. And so I think I always got kind of caught up in these little details, like, oh yeah, he must be really hungry. Or like, he really wants to have some power, or like he really needs some heavenly aid in this moment. But I think it's actually less about Jesus' monetary needs and more about the greatest temptation that Jesus will face as a human in his ministry. If you notice, first of all, the Spirit has led him into the wilderness. He didn't just stumble into the wilderness. The Spirit led him to the wilderness for an intentional time of refining. An intentional season of trial. This season is intended to prepare him, and it's going to launch him into the rest of his ministry. And so we have to pay attention here, because what we know here at the beginning of ministry is that what's occurring here is going to make a huge impact for the rest of the ministry. And so you notice this phrase keeps popping up, if you are the Son of God, do this. If you are the Son of God, do that. And I think when I read the text, so many times I just thought, well, of course it's the Son of God. You know, that's not really a question. I kind of glossed over it. But then I started to really think about it. If you are the Son of God, what does that imply? Well, it implies here that there might be a temptation for Jesus to prove himself. If you are the Son of God, do this. If you are the Son of God, demonstrate your power. Call down the angels. And Jesus resists. Jesus does not give in to this temptation. Why does Jesus not give in to this temptation? Well, Jesus knows who he is. Jesus is firmly planted in his identity that God gave him. God tells Jesus, you are my son whom I love. That's it. And so he is not going to actually have to go out into the world and prove that to anybody. He knows it. God knows it. And that's good enough. And so what we see here is Jesus is resisting this rat race that we're all caught up in. As a human being, he is saying, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and detach myself from the expectations of this world. And it's a really good thing that he does that in this season, because immediately following the wilderness scene, he's going to go and find himself in a crowd that doesn't like him so much. You know, at first they're kind of impressed, but then they're going to try to run him off a cliff. Things escalate pretty quickly, actually, in that story. But he doesn't get into it. He's prepared for a context where he is going to be rejected, where he might be tempted to say, no, wait a minute, you don't know who I am. Let me show you what I can do. Let me prove myself. Let me pull some strings so you know what power I wield. But he doesn't do that. And again in his ministry, people are going to come to him and say, hey, we heard about you. Why don't you do some miracles? Why don't you do some signs? Why don't you show us who you are? And Jesus resists. No, you won't get signs. No, I'm not going to prove it to you. And usually Jesus also adds a word like, you wouldn't believe it anyways. There's nothing I could do. It would never be good enough. Which speaks truth to our predicament, right? That it would never be good enough for us to prove ourselves. It's never enough. And so Jesus resists reaching for this power, reaching for these things. He knows he has it, but he's not going to wield it out of selfish ambition. In fact, you could kind of say that Jesus is living, demonstrating in this moment, this palms-up ministry, is what I like to call it. That rather than like closed fists, like clenching to power, reaching for more power, you know, trying to claw his way through this world, then Jesus is like this, receiving from God and giving to the world with no urgency to prove himself. No urgency to demand more power. Non-anxious. And this posture will define his ministry. And so from here, I'm kind of called to reflect on my closed fist. All the strings of power that I hold on to, the things that I demand from this world, from my job, from my husband, from my family, from my contacts, things I'm trying to demand to make me feel better. So, okay, I'm not enough in this world. What can I do to trick everyone? Rather than letting go. And that's so hard. I mean, we kind of get gridlocked here in this posture. But what if we just started the painful process of releasing our head? Deciding, you know what, today, I'm not going to let this thing define me. Today, I'm just going to receive from God and give to others. I think it would change the way we view ourselves. I think it would change the way we view one another. We have plagued ourselves with this tendency since Eden. I mean, you think about the snapshot of Adam and Eve doing the big bad sin, right? And what is their emotion? It's this, right? Grabbing, reaching for something that wasn't theirs? Something that wouldn't solve their problems? When God had supplied everything they could ever need, everything they could ever want, and abundantly more, they still tend to say, you know what, that system's not going to work for us. We're going to go ahead and try to manipulate the system here. We're going to reach for more. And we've been reaching for more ever since. We have an insatiable hunger for more. We fooled ourselves into thinking that God isn't enough. And what I think is really interesting is we have a whole history in our faith that is constantly trying to remind us God does provide. No matter what wilderness you find yourself in, God will always provide. God will always give you what you need. Why do you reach for things that you were never supposed to reach for? Why do you try to secure yourself beyond the providence of God? And I think it's really fascinating that this story in Luke 4, intentionally mirrors the time of the Israelites in the wilderness. If you start to look down at the language, you can see the temptation to worship somebody other than God. Well, in the wilderness, what's going to anchor the community is a dedication and a trust to the one and only God. God's going to provide manna, but is it enough? God's going to provide water, but is it enough? No, they continue to grumble and complain, right? It's never enough. And so what we find here in Jesus is taking up this age-old problem that we have. Jesus is taking up the core of the human struggle, our selfishness, our hubris. And Jesus is going to cast it all aside. And he's going to say, you know what? That's not going to define my ministry. And, you know, I've thought about this. What if Jesus tried to prove himself? Like, what if Jesus felt this anxiety to go out into the world and say, you know what? I am the Son of God, and you just wait. Let me show you. Let me show you what I can do, you know? I think it would have ruined the whole thing. I mean, not only is it not in the nature of the Son of God to do something like that, but the ministry would not have worked. And let's think even further as we talk about the cruciform way of life. How in the world would Jesus have endured betrayal and death on a cross if he was trying to prove himself? I think that's why Jesus doesn't call down a fleet of angels. He's tempted first in Luke 4, and later on, he will resist temptation again. No, that's not what this is going to be about. Sure, this world is, kind of after you. Like, it's kind of a dangerous, precarious place for us. You know, by the world's standards, you're not going to be enough. You're going to be strange. But you don't need it. God provides. Fundamentally, God provides, God sustains, God gives you your identity and gives you everything you need. And so you're not going to have to reach for things that are not yours to grab. I'm always reminded of this when I reflect on one of my more stupid moments in my life. I have a collection of memories that I just try to forget most of the time. But every now and then I'll share them for humor's sake. And so you should feel privileged. I'm going to let you in on an embarrassing story. When I was an undergrad at Lipscomb University, one of my professors required that we go to a church service that was different from our own upbringing. So I had grown up Church of Christ, and I decided I was going to go to an Episcopal service, an Ash Wednesday Episcopal service. Now, how many of you grew up Church of Christ? I would imagine a lot of you, right? How many of you have ever been to an Episcopal service? It's pretty different, isn't it? Like, unimaginably different. In a Church of Christ service, it's very, like, you know, roots organic. Like, you don't really have to show up and do much. You kind of go, and they're going to tell you what to do. You know, stand for this song. So come and stand and sing, you know? And then you're going to sit, and then you pass trays. Like, you get used to the kind of thing. In fact, you could spend the entire church service just sitting in the pew, and you'd be just fine. And an Episcopal service is a little bit more kinesthetic than that. You're standing, and then you're kneeling, and then you're on the floor, and then you're, you know, halfway up and down. Like, you're all over the place, and then the priest is saying something, and you're supposed to say something back. And I'm looking around during this service, like, how did I not get the memo? Is there a script? Like, I missed something? So I'm watching this older woman who looks like an expert in Episcopal services. I mean, she's probably the one who is there for Mass at 6 a.m. every day. And so I'm watching her, just like kind of preparing myself with every move that we make up and down. And I know it's an Ash Wednesday service. So I know things are gonna get a little bit different, like crazy different. Like we're gonna have to get up and do more things than I'm even used to. So eventually it's time for Holy Communion, Eucharist. And I'm expecting trays, because that's how we do it in my church. I'm expecting trays with my own little cup and my own little cracker. And if you go to a fancy church, sometimes you even get like a little nugget of a cracker. Like you just pick it up and go. You don't even have to break the cracker. And so that's kind of what I'm imagining here. But that's not the case. Pretty soon, before I even realize, everybody's gathering in the aisle. So I'm like, am I allowed to be a part of this? Do I get in the aisle? Like, what do I do? I'm trying not to stand out. So I watch this older woman. I'm like, I'm just going to follow her. You know, so she gets in line. I get right behind her. And I'm standing there wondering, like, what's coming? I don't know. And I feel like I can't breathe because I don't know what I'm doing. And we get up towards the front. And I'm very short. I know my personality makes me seem like I'm like 7 feet tall, but I'm like under 5 feet tall. And I cannot see anything. I can't see around this crowd. I can't see beyond the woman in front of me. So she's next, and she kneels. And she receives ashes. And then she needs to go over to receive Holy Communion. And I get to see how she takes the bread. They give her the bread. They actually place it on her tongue. And I'm like, okay. But then it's time for me to kneel and receive the ashes. And so she's moved on to the next station, and I don't really see what's coming. And so I'm like watching out the corner of my eye, but also trying to soak in the moment. You know, so he says those words, from dust you came, to dust you return. And then I'm up, and I'm looking. I find the bread, I kneel. And then I feel so ridiculous. Like, I can't grab it. Like, do I open my mouth? Is he gonna, like... And sure enough, so, like, I'm sitting there wide-eyed, and he lowers it, and I open my mouth like a baby bird, and he gives me the bread. So then, I'm like, well, the juice has to be around here somewhere. And so I shift over, like on my knees, shift over now. And here is the next portion with the wine, as I found out, not grape juice. The wine, but instead of lots of little cups, there's one big cup. And I'm like, huh, do they have more cups? Where is he keeping all his cups? I don't understand. And so he starts to bend down his cup, and I go to reach it. Like, I'm like, okay. And he does one of these, he's like. And I was like, he knows I'm not a Episcopal. Oh my God, he knows I'm not a Episcopalian. And so then I'm like, oh no, I'm gonna get kicked out here. Like, they're gonna escort me out. I've violated Holy Communion. And so then he comes back. I'm like, he's had a change of heart. Okay, so he comes back and I go again. I haven't really calculated that I'm not supposed to be reaching for this cup. And so he extends it and I try to grab it again and he's like, you know, very stern. And he's like, no, no. And I was like, so then I'm like, oh, this is another baby bird thing. Like, I'm supposed to. And so I put my arms down to my side and I open my mouth and he funnels it down and like I can feel it like dribbling. Like there's like a skill to this. I don't know what it was. Very clumsily received that communion. And then I scurry off. My face is beet red. I scurry off and sit in the back for the rest of the service. And I'm just like rattled. I mean, I'm shaking. I'm nervous. I'm like, what in the world just happened? And you know, I laugh when I think about that now. It's been some years. I've seen a therapist. Everything's fine now. But I reflect on that experience. And I, you know, I love the way that we do communion in Churches of Christ. I really love it. I love that everybody gets to hand it to their neighbor. Like, I think that's beautiful. But here's something that I realized. I didn't realize this was happening to me, but I got really used to the kind of individual nature of it. And I also got really used to just, like, waiting for my chance to take it. Like, I'm going to take this cup. It's my cup. I'm going to take this bread. It's my bread. And I began to think, how often do I treat Christ like that? How often do I treat God like that? One more device for me to manipulate. One more place for me to go just to feel a little better about myself. If I could just wield this power, I could prove myself. And what that moment in that Episcopal church taught me is actually I have fooled myself into believing I could actually grab or seize something that was never mine to take. And even more ironically, it was being given to me freely. That God gives you security. God gives you a name. God gives you identity and purpose and value totally free. And we're like, no, no. Excuse us, we're just going to keep trying to reach for that which we're not supposed to. Because it makes us feel better. When really, we're going to have to, like, cringingly move our arms down to our side and receive. Why does that make me so uncomfortable? It was such a beautiful moment for me to have to receive it. To loosen my grip, lower my hands, and receive that which is being freely given to me. And so, as I think about what we're going to do when we leave here, you know, I know it's early in the week. We don't really want to do that math yet. We're still soaking up the sun and soaking up Tom Wright, and that's good. But, you know, our lives are waiting for us back home. And the same kind of behaviors and temptations and rhythms are waiting for us when we get back home. So you're going to go back to your church. If you're a messer, you're going to go back to your church. And you're going to have those elders meetings. And you're going to have those congregants that are hard to work with. You're going to have those places of struggle that you're returning to. And you're just going to hope that you're better equipped to manage them. Or maybe you're an educator. You're going to go back and maybe finish final grades. I know that's what I'll do. And you're going to kind of get back into the grind. Or you're going to be back at home with your family. The same stuff is waiting for you. How does this change that? What would it look like If we could just change our posture every day, at the start of every day, decide, I'm going to lean in to what God has given me freely and demand no more than that. That is my challenge for you. That is my challenge for me. I'm going to pray over us and we'll close out. Gracious God, thank you so much for bringing us here this week. We thank you so much for all the wisdom we are receiving. We thank you for the worship that we are getting to partake in with one another. God, I pray that you would convict me, that you would show me every part of my life that I'm confused about, all the illusions, that you would help me to see right through those things and to just rest completely in the gifts you have given me, to trust you completely to provide in my wilderness, God. I trust you to be my sole source of identity and the only power in this universe. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Let the weak say, I am strong. Let the poor say,
God bless you.